Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Elon Musk is the richest person in the world, and now he's one of the most influential people in American politics. He has the ear of our incoming president, lucrative government contracts to launch rockets into space, and a social media platform where he can share all his thoughts and ideas. But what makes him tick? Why did Musk want to buy Twitter in the first place? These are the questions two New York Times journalists set out to answer. Their new book, Character Limit, is a well-researched exploration of Elon's Twitter takeover and a behind-the-scenes glance into the man himself. Joining us now are the authors, New York Times reporters Kate Conger, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you.
And Ryan Mack. Welcome back, Ryan.
Thanks for having us.
Musk is such a major character in American politics right now, but you both began writing this book long before he jumped on the Donald Trump train. So what first sparked the idea?
Well, I think we were really interested in his offer to buy Twitter and the significance it had over political conversation and online conversation more broadly. And the way that Musk operates is just so different from any other businessman of his stature. And not only is he a fascinating character, but he had all of these fascinating characters around him who were helping him pull off this crazy takeover. And so we were really drawn to the richness of the story, the significance of the deal itself, and these really interesting, raw characters that he surrounds himself with.
I have to say, the book reads like a thriller novel, very well written. Like, you keep turning the page like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, we wanted it, and I haven't figured out a way to say this without making a kind of hokey pun on the title, but we really wanted something that was character driven and felt like a novel, and that, you know, it wasn't going to feel like a sort of, I don't know, dry business book.
That's what I was a little worried when it came in, and I was like, oh, that's a really big book and it could really go either way. But once I got into it, I was like, oh, thank God, it's wonderful. And it's a page turner.
And it could have been longer. I mean, we filed a much longer manuscript, and not to spoil anything, but the book ends pretty early in the relationship of Trump and Musk. And we had to do it because we had to get this book out before the election. It was our goal. But yeah, at this point, we could probably have another.
I smell book a sequel.
Out. Yeah, though, I don't know, Kate, we want to take a little bit of a break,
that's
and we
fair.
Have our day jobs, too. So,
yeah.
But yeah, there's just been a lot that's happened.
Yeah, the book's title is Character Limit, which is obviously a play on Twitter, now X's limit, on how many characters you can type per post. But I really did feel like it was also a reference to Musk himself and his personality.
Yeah, I mean, we really felt like Musk met his match in Twitter. And, you know, prior to this acquisition, I think he was seen as someone with unparalleled success, a technical genius who was able to pull off, you know, both Tesla and SpaceX, these technical innovations that no one thought possible. And his collision with Twitter really started to reveal some of the darker parts of his own character and challenge him in ways I don't think he was prepared for.
I want to talk about Musk's personality because the book is full of anecdotes about the South African-born billionaire. In fact, you open with one about a data scientist who is about to go into a meeting with Musk soon after he's purchased Twitter. Ryan, why did you choose this as the opening scene?
It was actually something we struggled with, was how do we start this book and like what encapsulates, you know, everything about this deal. And this reporting actually came closer towards the end of our process. But it's a scene that happens actually in the days after he takes over the company. You know, this is late October 2022, early November 2022. And there's a data scientist who is quite optimistic about Elon's takeover initially. You know, bear in mind, not everyone at Twitter was opposed to him taking over, and some were excited about his prospects of leading a company as been very successful at Tesla and SpaceX. But in the days after the takeover, Elon engages with this conspiracy theory about Nancy Pelosi's husband. You know, he was attacked in his home, and Elon shares this link to essentially a conspiracy site saying that this is actually a lover's tryst gone wrong, and that's how we should be looking at this incident. And for the data scientists who had seen, I guess, the turmoil of the hours and days after the initial takeover, this was kind of the last straw. You know, this is someone who had studied misinformation at the company and seen how it affects people, and basically was like, you know, you have to be in the like very, very unskeptical, or at least, you know, he said something like only 10% of people in the world would fall for something like this. And for it to be the person who owned Twitter was very telling for him. And he kind of quits on the spot, and they have this aggressive arguing match that leads to his immediate firing, essentially. And we felt like that was a perfect way to like encapsulate everything that was going on in this acquisition.
I think it shows, at least to me, very quickly that Musk doesn't tolerate criticism. In that sense, I think he really reminded me of President-elect Donald Trump. They don't like being told no.
Yeah, they don't like being challenged, and this is something we heard over and over again in our reporting. Actually, in one-on-one cases, we've heard people say, you know, Musk can be quite reasonable, but in large group settings, he can't be seen as someone who isn't the smartest person in the room, and he hates being challenged. There are other incidents in the book where he fires people on the spot for bringing up, you know, and challenging him on certain things. One example is around the Super Bowl when an employee stood up and said, actually, you know, the reason why your tweets aren't getting as much engagement anymore is probably because you're not as popular, or people are getting tired of you. And yeah, it's a
That was the
theme
wrong thing
throughout
to
the
say,
book.
apparently.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, Kate, you have this, you report these scenes where people in his inner circle, people close to Elon, advise others on how to talk to him. One aide to Musk tells a Twitter employee that Elon is special. What does that mean?
Yeah, so this is something that's so interesting is that the people in his inner orbit have all sort of devised their own strategies on how to stay there and their ways of talking to him and relating to him that seemed to work. And so after the transition, when he bought the company, his aides were telling people, this is how you deal with him. No, this is how you deal with them, and trying to advise people on how they could stay in the orbit. And what a lot of these people believe who work really closely with Musk is that he is special, that he has this sort of humanitarian mission, whether that's saving the planet through Tesla, saving humanity by establishing colonies on Mars, or saving free speech through the acquisition of Twitter. They really believe in this sort of mission-driven story that he tells for himself. And so they need to protect him or protect his mission and sort of streamline him towards these goals.
Yeah, I think it was one of the articles you've written more recently, Ryan, where you described him as the hero of his own science fiction novel. And I feel like that's been the most apt way for me personally, as an avid reader of fantasy and science fiction, to sort of
Yeah.
conceptualize how he sees the world.
Yeah, he was a big consumer of science fiction and fantasy novels in his youth. And to understand Elon Musk is, you know, he is the making of his own narrative. He is the hero at the center of it all. You know, when you think about his companies, for example, SpaceX is on a mission to make humans multiplanetary because he believes there's going to be a catastrophic event that leads to, you know, the destruction of Earth. And so we need to get humans to another planet, and he's going to be the person that does that. With Tesla, it's, you know, the environment is in trouble, and we need an electric car company to take us away from fossil fuels, and he's going to be the person to bring about that electric car revolution. And similarly with Twitter, you know, he gave himself this mission of saving quote unquote free speech. You know, we can debate what that means, but this is something that he fundamentally believes in his mind. And now you see it also playing out again with this D Department of Government efficiency, right? Whatever this position, unofficial or official, that he's given himself in the Trump administration, where he's going to try and cut the government and or cut spending in the government because he believes the federal government is on a crash course of bankruptcy. You know, these are kind of existential crises that he's developed in his mind, and he's the person to save us from them.
So you get the impression throughout the book that Musk wants to be respected. But one of the things I didn't see coming, and I guess I should have if I read a lot more of his tweets, is that he wants to be seen as funny. I get the sense that he wants to be this cool, smart guy with the funny jokes, which is why he carries a literal porcelain sink into Twitter headquarters when he finalizes the deal. Can one of you explain why he's carrying a porcelain sink?
Yeah, so you're right. I mean, Musk has always been really interested in humor. He has talked over the years about starting a competitor to The Onion and really wanted to rescue the account of the Babylon Bee, which is a right-wing satirical website that was banned by the previous leadership of Twitter. That was one of his big things that he wanted to do once he bought the company, was bring them back. So he is really interested in humor, and specifically online humor, meme culture. And so that's what he's echoing when he comes into Twitter the day before the acquisition carrying his porcelain sink. There's this sort of overused phrase online, let that sink in, and people will sort of punctuate tweets with it or posts online to try to kind of express the gravity of a situation. But, you know, it's sort of been mocked and memed with this image of a sink like standing outside of a doorway waiting to be let into a home, right?
Oh, it's a good pun.
Right. And so, you know, it's just sort of like a way of mocking this trite, overused online phrase. And so that's what he's kind of echoing in that moment where he comes into Twitter carrying the sink, that he's this online meme lord come to take over the meme factory.
When we set out with our reporting goals, when we started this book, one of them was to try and find out who was tasked with buying that sink.
Who bought the sink?
Really wanted to find the intern in charge of the sink purchase.
We never did. Oh. But so if you're out there, we're still reporting it out. So give us a shout.
I know. That's like getting the name of the dog. Like, you definitely want to know who bought the sink.
Yeah.
You really do. Yeah.
We spent a lot of time looking. But to your point on being funny, I mean, there's a scene in the book where he's at a Dave Chappelle show.
Yeah.
After the company is acquired, and he, you know, it's at Chase Center, the big basketball stadium where the Warriors play, and Chappelle's killing it on stage, and he brings out Elon and just totally kills the vibe. You know, all these people start booing. Elon just kind of stands there and tries to say things. It just continues to get booed. And in that moment, you can see in these videos that were shot, like, it just kind of kills him, to the point where he goes on Twitter in the hours after and starts fighting with people and arguing with them. You know, it wasn't all boos. It was, you know, it was actually 90% cheers and 10% boos. And, you know, he tweeted, and then he actually deletes it. And so being loved and being adored and being seen as funny is like pretty crucial to his being. And it like severely hurts him when he's not seen that way. And I think that's one of the most human things about him.
Yeah. It is hard to watch those videos. If you Google Elon Musk and Dave Chappelle, I had to like cover my, I'm really a, like, I feel secondhand shame very deeply. It's hard for me to watch fictional characters be embarrassed, but I covered my eyes for most of that because it's hard to watch.
It is. And he comes out again too. It's like, it happens twice. And like, it actually is quite interesting. I don't want to like psychoanalyze Dave Chappelle. I know he lives in Ohio, or at least for parts of the year he lives in Ohio.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was such a miscalculation on Dave Chappelle's part too. Like, he's someone who's like so good at comedy and like reading the room. And it's just interesting to see him just like kill the mood. And it's the end of the show too. So it's like devastating for both of them.
Yeah. I do think it's one of the most humanizing things that comes across in the book. And, you know, this ideal of absolute free speech, that we don't moderate content on platforms, he's a dyed-in-the-wool true believer. This is not something he's arguing, like, because conservatives want him to argue it. I think he believes this on a really fundamental level.
You know, it's funny. I think he believes it when it comes to speech that he enjoys, right? Hmm. I mentioned earlier this instance of the Babylon Bee, which is a right-wing satirical website that was banned. He brought their account back, and that's the kind of speech that he enjoys and he wants to defend. But we've also seen Twitter, or now X under his leadership, censor a BBC documentary in India on behalf of the Modi government because, you know, he's received takedown requests and he's not interested in defending that kind of speech. So it is really dependent on his interests and his views about what kind of speech he finds valuable, rather than a maximalist approach of everyone can post everything that they want all the time.
He's gotten into trouble for it too.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. I mean, the Brazil example recently, he was trying to keep up posts that the government wanted removed, and it resulted in Twitter being banned in Brazil temporarily. I mean, it's definitely been an issue for him. He's spooked advertisers with his own posts, appearing to, for instance, endorse the Great Replacement theory, and then kind of backtracking from that when he got backlash from advertisers. But, you know, it's been a persistent problem for him. And I think part of the problem is that he's really struggled to define what his free speech values are. It changes by the day.
Yeah, he also got sued civilly by a man named Vernon Unsworth, a diver who helped rescue those kids and the soccer coach that were trapped in a cave in Thailand in like 2018. He apparently Vernon like takes a swipe at Musk and his attempts to rescue. So Musk is like, "Yeah, I bet he's a pedophile." And I don't know.
Yeah, it's one of the ways we begin the book, and he calls him a pedo guy after their kind of argument. Actually, it wasn't really an argument, Vernon Unsworth, not to get too in the weeds here, but calls this rescue attempt by Elon Musk basically faulty and unusable. He built a submarine to get these kids out of a cave in Thailand. And for Unsworth, in turn, is called a pedo guy by Musk, who then, Unsworth then sues Musk for defamation in a US court. We trace a lot of kind of Elon's unaccountability or his understanding that he is unaccountable to that trial. He ends up winning that trial for
Yeah.
defamation, and it kind of sets him on this path where he realizes he can say what he wants online, he can do whatever he wants, he can fight it if he's sued, and he's going to come out on top. He was far less wealthy back then, far less powerful. And I feel like a lot of stuff flows from that, this realization that he is in some ways above the law or above,
He doesn't play by the same rules as the rest of us.
exactly. Yeah. And most folks when in that position would probably settle. They would probably say, like, it's not worth my time to testify and be deposed and go through discovery and go through this very embarrassing trial. There are a lot of embarrassing things that came out in the course of that trial. For one, Elon hired a fake private investigator, someone he didn't know who was posing as a private investigator to investigate these claims of pedophilia. He was trying to make these claims
Because it's
true
not
about
libel
this
if you're
man.
truth.
Right. And so he hired this guy who emailed him out of the blue, who ended up being a con man, and paid this guy $50,000 to do this. And it was like just so embarrassing and so kind of slapstick in a way. And he doesn't care. At the end of the day, he wins the trial. He's the champion and he moves on with his life. And from there, everything kind of flows. Tesla gets way more valuable. SpaceX gets way more valuable. He's kind of unaccountable to anything he says on Twitter. And, he ends up buying the platform.
That was Ryan Mack, one of the co-authors of Character Limit. Coming up, what happens when Elon Musk buys Twitter? That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Elon Musk is a polarizing figure in American politics. The right loves him. The left seems to hate him right now, but no one can deny the influence he wields after the re-election of Donald Trump. We're spending this hour with the authors of a new book, Character Limit: How Elon Musk Destroyed Twitter. The book was written by New York Times technology reporters Kate Conger and Ryan Mack. So Musk starts buying shares of Twitter in the spring of 2022, and within weeks he has nearly 10% of the company, which might not sound like a lot, but apparently it makes him the largest shareholder of Twitter. And the board has no idea that he's done this, which is like wild to me. So suddenly they're just like, oh, Musk owns the biggest share of our company.
Yeah, and this is especially crazy considering the fact that they had just had another activist in their stock doing something similar a couple years earlier. And you would think that they might try to be a little bit more careful about detecting this kind of activity. It was something that executives at the company were worried about, that they would have another activist come in. But somehow Musk was able to slip by and then announces himself as the largest shareholder, and it catches the board off guard, and they very quickly have to scramble and try to figure out how to appease him, what does he want? And they end up offering him a seat on the board and trying to basically placate him, bring him into the fold. Musk accepts that offer and then very quickly decides he doesn't want to do it. He doesn't like the idea of being one voice among many. He wants to be the only voice in the room. And so he moves forward with a takeover.
Yeah, and it seems like he decides he doesn't want to be one voice among many. There's this moment where the new CEO, so Jack Dorsey, has left Twitter, and there's this new CEO, and he pushes back on Musk. And then Musk just like erupts and seems like a switch is flipped, and he's like, "You know what? I'm just going to buy the whole thing."
Yeah, this CEO is Parag Agrawal, who was the CEO for essentially a couple months, Jack Dorsey's handpicked successor. And initially, their relationship was quite good. You know, he was receptive to Elon's feedback. They were kind of going back and forth on text. Remember, Elon Musk has a great reputation in the Valley among engineers. You know, he's been very successful. He's built these kind of
Yeah.
historical companies, and that's how Parag Agrawal viewed him initially. But then his feedback gets to be a bit too much, and he starts to kind of badger Parag about every little thing he sees on the site. And one day, Parag pushes back a little bit and says, "Actually, you know, please don't do what you're doing." Elon was essentially tweeting out his criticisms of the company. You sit on the board, you have a responsibility as a board member to uphold, you know, the reputation of this company. And he just snaps. You know, Elon at the time was in Hawaii vacationing on Lanai, and kind of just makes this snap decision to be like, "You know what? Screw this. I'm going to buy the whole company. I don't need to be one of 10 or, you know, one of a group of people. I'm just going to own the whole thing."
And very few people in the world would have the cash to do this. It's not very often you take a publicly traded company and return it to private ownership. How does he come up with the price offer that he makes? Because this made me laugh.
So it's a weed joke. He offers 54.20 per share, and it's a joke that he's made in the past. When he was talking about taking Tesla private and doing a similar thing with his own company, he said he would pay 4.20 per share for Tesla shares. And so he's sort of echoing or calling back to this joke that he's made before with the offer to pay 54.20. And you know, total that up, it's $44 billion. It's an incredible amount of money. And while Musk has the wealth to do it, he doesn't want to be on the hook for that full price. So he very quickly starts scrambling around and asking friends, investors to put in money and help fund this deal.
And what I find so strange about all of this is there comes a time where Musk tries to back out of the deal. He thinks, at the very least, this 54.20 per share is too much. He's buying it at too high a price. And the board doesn't want to sell to Musk. They don't think he'll be good for the company. But so Elon doesn't want to buy it, or at least at the price he's offering. The board doesn't want to sell it, but they're forced to sue him to go through with the deal anyway.
Yeah, it's this really bizarre moment where no one wants this to happen, and yet everyone is bound to do it because they've signed this merger agreement. And, you know, the board in this context has a fiduciary duty to the shareholders. They have to get them the best price possible. And Musk has offered this overly inflated price. And so they're sort of duty bound to force him to pay it, even though no one involved really wants it to happen.
It's such a weird quirk of capitalism to me.
It
It
is
is.
really weird.
It's one of the themes throughout the book that in some ways Elon Musk is a man that broke capitalism, or like, you know, companies are supposed to be bought by companies, not individual people. And you have someone who at that point had amassed a net worth of $200 billion and on a whim could just one day be like, "You know what? I'm going to buy this $44 billion company." You know, we think of billionaires as people who buy yachts or islands or sports teams, but to buy a whole company and one that oversees, you know, discussions online, you know, a major media platform is unprecedented. Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post years ago, but that was a $250 million purchase. This is $44 billion. And since then, Elon's net worth has gone up even more. I mean, he's now floating around 330 billion dollars of net worth, even with the hit he took on this Twitter deal. And he has, in some ways, kind of escaped the accountability of any, you know, he's so rich, he's unaccountable. There's no way to hold him accountable, you know, and it's one of the main messages of the book.
Yeah, Musk takes over the company in late October. It's actually the day of Twitter's family-friendly Halloween party, which makes for this, like, I don't know, it's like this dark and sad scene. Like, they're all in costumes, but they're all getting canned.
It was, yeah, one of the more bizarre moments of reporting this book. The Halloween party was happening, and I believe it's a Thursday night, and the deal was supposed to close on Friday, but Musk was, like always, saying, hurry up and get it done. I want it to close now. So they push forward with the close, and he's signing paperwork in one part of the building while employees are assembling in another part of the building for this Halloween party. There's rumors going around that Musk might be in costume and infiltrating the party, even though he's not. There are some people who are trying to move forward with the celebration and eat, drink, be merry, and there's other people crying in the corners and hugging each other. And I mean, it's just one of these surreal moments in this story where we felt like if we were writing fiction, we couldn't get away with this,
Yeah. The other one I just couldn't believe, Ryan, is he starts cutting costs everywhere. He's going to try and make Twitter profitable, and this includes firing the maintenance staff. And you share this story about getting a photograph of the toilet paper in the bathroom. What? I was like, this can't be real. Oh my goodness.
So much of this was like when we heard it, we're like, please, you know, to our sources, please verify this with us because we can't put this in the New York Times or our book without actual proof because it's so ridiculous in some ways. But yeah, Elon came in with a staff that was ordered to basically fight every cost or debate every cost. If, you know, the rent was too high, they just simply wouldn't pay it, and they would use that as a negotiating tactic. And at one point, the janitorial services at their offices in New York and SF and LA, some of their main offices, weren't being paid because they just simply thought the bill was too high. And so the janitors simply walked out, and that meant the trash wasn't being taken out. It meant that the bathrooms weren't being cleaned, and the toilet paper wasn't being replenished. And at one point in New York, we get a photo from one of our sources who says, "Look, someone actually had to bring in their own toilet paper, and in order to like make a spool, they had taken a metal hanger and used it and created like kind of a makeshift spool that they hung on the side of the stall." And it was just so ridiculous, but kind of a perfect encapsulation of the cost cutting that went on at the company at that time.
Yeah, and I think, Ryan talked about just some of the surreal qualities of this reporting process. I think, you always want to be skeptical as a reporter when you're hearing things, make sure that you're verifying it. But I think that our entrance into Elon world was just so unbelievable. And there were so many things where, we're talking to sources that we trusted and have known for a long time and just thinking, this can't be real. We need more evidence, more proof. And so I think that was something that was really a driving factor in the book that we just wanted to, triple confirm all of these things because they just sounded insane.
Yeah, I mean, and the cost cutting from there flowed into cutting like parental ser like egg freezing services and rents, and at one point employees were sleeping in the office. They created something called the Twitter Hotel where they put beds in the office in conference rooms because they didn't want people paying for outside hotel rooms because they thought that would be a super like you know a cost that they didn't need to have on the company. So it was just absolutely absurd at some point.
Musk also comes up with a bunch of ideas for generating more money, for increasing revenue at Twitter. He wants to move away from advertising, so he starts selling verification, those little blue check marks that I used to have once upon a time before you had to pay a monthly fee to get them. But that doesn't generate the money that Musk thought it would.
Yeah, and I think that this is something, just zooming out a little bit, this is something that Twitter has always struggled with. There's this group of hardcore addict users that are on the platform all day, every day, and they have very different needs and desires than the people who are the majority of the users, who are there to read or to lurk and maybe post very occasionally. But Musk is one of those people who spends all of his time online. He's a hardcore Twitter user. And so to him, verification felt very important. And he thought everyone on the platform would pay for this status symbol, when in fact, it's a status symbol that only really matters to the people who are, you know, Twitter addicts and spend all their time on the platform, or to people who really need it, like, you know, government services. You want to know that, like, the tweets that you're seeing from FEMA are the real FEMA and not an imposter. But he thought everyone would want to cough up $8 a month in order to have this verified status symbol on the platform, and that it would have broad appeal to the user base.
He also talked about converting X to a subscription service, having it be an all-in-one place for everything. At one point, he talked about making it a dating service.
Yeah, it was his grand idea, this thing called an everything app, which we see in places like China with WeChat, for example. You know, in China, you can use WeChat to order delivery food or hail a cab. And he thought Twitter or X could be this one-stop shop for everything, kind of underestimating how hard that would be. He started with a payments company, for example, and that still hasn't been rolled out. There are jobs functions. Yeah, like Venmo, and you can make payments to the app. He talked about dating service. He talked about a LinkedIn competitor. And he had all these kind of grand schemes for the thing. But by and large, X has not changed very much since he purchased the company in terms of the features and things that it offers. But this is what he had to promise, because he had outside investors, and he had to sell them on this vision that he could transform the company, that he could, you know, move it away from a 90% dependence on advertising, which is how the company made most of its money. And he still hasn't done that. And he's kind of sold investors down the river on this kind of vision.
Do you think he's happy with where Twitter sits financially? I know he's so wealthy, for him personally, it doesn't matter. But I mean, when he bought it, it was $44 billion. He thinks it's $19 billion now, but Fidelity values it at $12. I mean, that's well below what he paid for it.
Yeah, and I think the Fidelity valuation has gone down even more since. I think it's close to $9 billion now. So I don't think that he's particularly happy with the finances, but I think he's very happy with the influence that he's been able to buy himself with this purchase. I also think, you know, he's been able to take Twitter and spin it into new value, right? So he also has this company, XAI, which is an artificial intelligence company. And he recently raised money for that, I think at a value of $40 or $50 billion. That's training on all of the data from Twitter itself. So he's been able to take the value of Twitter and just kind of shift it into this new company and raise money on that. So I wouldn't say that it's a total loss for him. And he's been able to find other ways to monetize or value what he's bought with Twitter.
In some ways, I wonder if he bought his favorite toy when he bought Twitter, because it seems like he's very personally happy with the change in the feel of the platform or in the direction it's going.
Totally. That's how we viewed it at the time. It was his favorite thing in the world. It's where he spent so many hours of his day kind of making jokes and fighting with people and pushing it back against the media. And he bought it. And since then, he's become the most followed account. He's been able to drive out his critics or demote them in the algorithm and boost the people that he likes. And that's no more evident than what happened with the election. You know, these kind of pro-Trump voices were elevated on the platform dramatically. And so he's been quite happy with that. I don't, you know, I think at the same time we have to go back and say like that wasn't his intent when he set out to buy the platform. It wasn't this kind of 3D chess plan to get Trump elected. We have to remember at the time he actually didn't even support Donald Trump when he set out to buy the platform in 2000.
Wasn't he behind Ron DeSantis at one point?
He was, yeah, he was behind Ron DeSantis. He said Trump should sail into the sunset, and he had that launch event with DeSantis using Twitter Spaces, that kind of live audio platform that was disastrous in some way for the DeSantis campaign. And it wasn't until spring of this year that he kind of really warmed up to the idea of